Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look now at vaccinations, and it's the importance of vaccinating your children or making sure your grandchildren are vaccinated. Our guest today, Dr. James Conway, is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's been with us in the past. It's great to have him back to talk about vaccinations and certainly to answer your questions. You may have questions about certain types of vaccination. Is your child up to date on their vaccinations? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. Jim Conway, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Good to see you.
Great to see you again. Do most, how do vaccinations work?
Well, vaccinations work by basically stimulating the immune system and tricking it into thinking that it's already had the disease before, has already seen that organism, and is essentially prepared. So when and if you do get exposed, you're already ready to go.
And do most need a booster at some point?
Yeah, most of the vaccines are a series of vaccines, although there are some, especially the live viral vaccines, that certainly don't need as much of a boosting. They tend to really kick in and work much more effectively. But most of them, since they're, you know, a very small amount of the antigens, of the pieces of the organisms, do need a series of doses just to remind the immune system and keep it moving.
I was talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW Vet School, who had a rabies shot 14, 15 years ago, and had a terrible reaction to it, so hives and everything else, but she's a vet. But they test her every year, and even though it was only supposed to last a couple of years, it's still effective 14 years later. So sometimes,
yeah, most of them actually work very, very effectively for most people. And, you know, there are some of the vaccines, we give them a few doses to make sure that they've got full response and that immunity carries for a long period of time.
How does a vaccination differ from immunization? Is there...
They're basically the same thing. I mean, the term vaccination actually comes from the vaccinia virus, which was the type of virus that was used on the original smallpox vaccine. Basically that term then became interchangeable with immunization. But there's a subtle difference, because vaccination is the process of giving the person the antigen, and immunization is basically the process and the response then of the immune system responding to what you've done.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. You think about the value of these vaccines and these vaccinations. What diseases have we been able to eradicate or at least greatly reduce the risk of as a result of vaccination?
Well, there's two diseases that we've ever eradicated from the face of the earth by immunization. One was smallpox, obviously. And then the other, actually, in reference to your veterinary friend's comment, was Rinderpest, which was a virus that used to rage through domestic herds and really caused a lot of problems. And by really active immunization programs, both of those diseases were able to be completely eradicated from the face of the earth. We've been able to manage then and get rid of at least regular circulation in most areas of the world with polio and up until recently with measles by, again, having very, very good herd immunity by getting enough people immunized that we were able to stop circulation. But as you know, the problem now is that some of those diseases are starting to reemerge.
Yeah, because people aren't getting their kids vaccinated.
I mean, I think that's one of the components. I think there's people that are hesitant about the vaccines as the diseases become less common. I think people don't worry about them or fear them as much as they did. We certainly have systems issues in some areas of the world, and certainly in the United States, some people have access issues where there really aren't readily available immunizers nearby.
And certainly in some circles, there is a concern that vaccines are dangerous and can have serious negative impacts. What do you say to those, to put those folks' minds at ease?
Well, there's a number of things. I think one is to recognize that the process of testing and approving vaccines and really ensuring the safety of vaccines is much more rigorous and really much more elaborate than it is for most drugs. You know, I think for most medications, you have a person who has a condition or a number of people, you give them the medication, the condition gets better, and you can look and make sure that the side effects are tolerable. Vaccines are different. You're giving them to well people, And the idea is that basically you don't want anything to happen. And so because of that, the FDA and all the companies that develop and manufacture vaccines really do hold them to a very, very different standard. So instead of, you know, 5 or 10,000 people that they're tested on, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people. And then even beyond that, there's a very, very active process through a number of different programs, the Vaccine Safety Data Link and the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, that constantly monitor for any signals that might signal that there might be something wrong with any particular vaccine. And it certainly works quite well. We've had a few vaccines that did come off the market shortly after they were on the market because there was enough of an issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Marty in La Pointe, Wisconsin has a question for you. Hi, Marty. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Love the topic. In the opening comments, the idea of interjecting or putting this vaccination in to stimulate the body's natural defense is right on. But my question is, especially for vaccine manufacturers, is how does the introduction of mercury and other heavy metals in some of these vaccinations do the body good? How does that stimulate the body's health in any way, shape, or form?
Thanks, Marty. Good question, and we'll need to make sure we differentiate a couple of things. So mercury, in some of the older vaccines, was a preservative that was used. There was a chemical called thimerosal that had been around since way back in the 1920s and was a type of mercury that was very different from the types of mercury that we worry about that cause toxicity. So, you know, when we used to have all those thermometers and they'd break and you'd play hockey on the floor with the little ball of mercury. That was methyl mercury, and that was really a very concerning chemical, and that we really wanted to get out of the environment for a long time. Ethyl mercury, which was the preservative, doesn't have nearly those same biological side effects and is, in fact, considered inert. But fortunately, the companies have all figured out ways to essentially remove all of that type of preservative just in case there was anything to be concerned. There's a trace amount that shows up in a couple of the vaccines just because of a part of the process in keeping them sterile. But I think what you're asking about is more on the order of something like aluminum, which is something that in very small quantities is present in some of the vaccines as what's called an adjuvant. And the idea is that you can actually cut down the amount of antigen, the stuff that actually is the pieces of the organism that you're trying to get the immune system to respond to. You can actually cut down the amount that you need to have in the vaccine by putting something else in that helps the immune system respond a little bit better. And so one of the most effective ones of those are aluminum salts. And I think it's important for people to realize how common aluminum is. And in fact, aluminum is the most common metal in the Earth's crust. It's found in all the baby formulas, soy formula. It's actually found in breast milk. And babies, in fact, ingest more aluminum through just eating on a regular basis by far than the total amount of aluminum that's contained in all the vaccines they receive over their childhood. So it's one of those things that I think you really have to recognize. It's a proportional question that, yes, there's a little bit of it in there. It's in there for good reason. They really do try to minimize and remove anything that's not absolutely necessary. And then, in fact, these things are actually very common in the environment and are things that everybody's exposed to on a regular basis.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware that there was varying degrees of mercury as a consumer, but you know, with all of the recent press and publications and sort of, I don't want to discount them, but as a parent, obviously the concerns linking vaccinations and immunizations to some of your other childhood diseases or autism, it's something that obviously comes to a lot of people's minds, and of course we've had this anti-vaccination movement across the United States, and we've seen the long-term effects of that in New York recently, I believe. So I just wanted to clarify on that, and thank you for your comments.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, very good question, Marty, and I'm really glad you raised those issues because I think there are things that do prey on people's minds, and I think they're important to get out there and to discuss and try to reassure people.
He mentioned New York. Is there an issue there? And I should have. Is it something you were aware of?
Well, there's you know, small outbreaks and larger outbreaks all over the place. We've got measles outbreaks in a variety of places, including New York, Pennsylvania, and California.
Okay.
We've had mumps outbreaks in multiple areas across the Midwest over just this last year, and in fact had mumps cases throughout Wisconsin and on the UW campus here. So we've seen the reemergence of these diseases that we had under pretty good control, and they do pop up periodically and largely in communities where there's a number of people or groups of people that have chosen or been unable to immunize their children.
Yeah, I can tell you, I'm thinking back. I can remember having measles, as a matter of fact, and mumps as well. And it's something you don't really. And of course, this is when way back before there were probably appropriate vaccines for this sort of thing. I mean, all kids, I think, got. Like ours, as soon as one kid in the school got measles, then every kid in the school had measles.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people who haven't seen these diseases to really listen to people like you from and your generation and my generation, because I had mumps and I had chickenpox. And one of the things I always tell people is I would never wish on my worst enemy for anybody to go through either of those. Even though they don't kill a lot of people, they're really, really unpleasant. And the negative side effects after you recover are, in fact, sometimes lifelong.
Yeah. Dr. James Conway, our guest today, professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking with him about the importance of vaccinating our children. I hope you'll join in. We'll be back with him right after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look today at an important issue, and that relates to vaccinations and vaccinating your children. We want to keep our children safe. We teach them not to touch hot stoves or to look both ways when you cross the street, but one of the most important ways that we can protect our children is to make sure they're current on their vaccinations. And this is kind of the time of the year when you think about it. And Dr. James Conway with us to sort of remind us and get us going in the right direction here. He is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And certainly is more than happy to answer your questions when you call in. Maybe you've got some experiences to share as well. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And just before we get back onto the vaccinations, someone mentioned mercury, and we mentioned mercury thermometers, and that's a different kind of mercury.
Yeah, the point I was trying to make was that the mercury preservative that was in some of the vaccines for some time was an ethyl mercury, a really large molecule that just couldn't get into parts of the body to cause trouble. And I think the analogy I was trying to make was that the other forms of mercury, methyl mercury and elemental mercury, like there are in thermometers, are just these tiny molecules that can penetrate across that blood-brain barrier and cause neurological problems. And I do appreciate that people are aware of that and want to make sure that we're clear on that.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. Again, the number for you to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go back again. Just talking a bit, the concerns that vaccines may be dangerous. Let's talk about how do you put people's minds at ease?
Well, I think it's important to make sure that there's a balance as people are sort of thinking about things that worry them. And I think that when we are successful with our immunization programs, which we have been largely in this country, with most of the major diseases that kill kids down, 99% from the peaks that they had over the last century, I think we do get lulled into this false sense of security.
Yeah.
That these diseases really aren't something to be particularly concerned about. And, essentially people's concerns, I think, come down to two things. One is that they're not that concerned about the diseases, that the diseases aren't going to hurt their kid or that their kid isn't really susceptible to those diseases. And then the second is that they don't completely understand how complicated but also how really rigorous the process is for really looking at and guaranteeing safety of the vaccines. The process of vaccine and vaccine recommendations really coming to the point where primary care providers then are providing them is really much more complicated than I think for most other drugs, because the be-all and end-all is not the FDA when
yeah.
it comes to immunizations. The FDA basically looks at the data that the companies submit that goes along along with the vaccine and says, yes, we approve this, you can sell it. But there are actually a number of other sort of higher scientific organizations, especially the American Council on Immunization Practice and the CDC, who actually looked not only at just the information about that vaccine, but everything that's ever been published in the world's literature and every other country's experience about the other versions of the vaccines that have been out there. And they're really the ones that then make the recommendation for which vaccines should be given to who and which ones should be routinely recommended. So I think there's a number of other fail-safes in the system that really help us guarantee that safety.
And there are some genuine reactions to vaccinations. I've had vaccination where I wind up, I might have a little lump on my arm or something like that for a day or two. But how common are they?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge, and maybe we glossed over it a little bit too much in the past, but I think we need to acknowledge these are, you know, biological products and that they are stimulating the immune system. So I think it's actually very common. I mean, I get lots of vaccines. I travel all over the world. And it's common. They hurt. And, you know, your arm aches for a little while, and sometimes it gets a little red. And I think those are to be expected. And then, you know, there are other very, very rare side effects. And if any of those are of any significance happening in enough people to really sort of cause problems, those then become questions about, are these vaccines really worthwhile?
Yeah, and for sure. Are there some signs or things to watch for that?
Well, we've got a very active monitoring system. I mean, every provider is obligated, anybody that has anything that they think could be a vaccination reaction, they report those. And then there's a very active investigation process that's run by the federal government that looks into each and every one of those and constantly monitoring for each and every vaccine to look for signals about, is there any problem that we need to be aware of?
And there are some people who can't be vaccinated or cannot be vaccinated, I've been told. Is that correct?
That is. There are people that either have medical contraindications to vaccines or, you know, things like certain types of immune deficiencies or certain types of allergies. And those people then can't be vaccinated because they may actually have a reaction from the vaccine. And those people actually really depend on the rest of us for actually immunizing, because the herd immunity of the whole group of us is really what prevents these diseases from circulating.
Yeah. Yeah, and sort of the risks of declining rates of vaccination. I mean, that's the result is more mumps and more measles and or whatever.
Correct.
We have Liz in Wautoma with a question for you. Let's go to her. Thanks, Liz, for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm really interested in the field of vaccinations. I just want to, before I get into my question, I wanted to make a comment about reactions to vaccinations. My 3-year-old daughter has many diagnosed food allergies, and egg is one of them. So the pediatrician and I were torn between giving her a flu vaccination, and we ended up going to her allergist, and her allergist gave her the flu vaccination, and she was monitored for a number of hours until they deemed she wasn't having a reaction and, you know, was allowed to go home. But my question that I wanted to ask is, you know, when all parents have a new child, they take them to the pediatrician, and you immediately get this big card that has their vaccination schedule, and it's pretty overwhelming. And sometimes, you know, you maybe just need one vaccination, but and my daughter's up and coming 1-year appointment, she's going to need 4 or more. And I think to myself, that just seems like a lot, because you talked about you can have, you know, a sore injection site. But I also think when you have a 1-year-old or even an infant, what are those vaccinations doing in the body? I frequently ask, can I break those into multiple appointments? I don't want her to get more than 2 shots at once, because I just don't know how it makes a small child feel. And I'm just curious as to whether it has a huge impact on an infant's body getting 4 or more vaccinations in one visit.
Yeah. Good comments and good questions. I mean, first on the flu vaccine and the egg issue, I think we used to make more of that than it really needed. And in fact, if people can eat, we used to say if you can eat a muffin, which has about the same amount of egg protein as the vaccine, you could be vaccinated safely. And now with further studies, it turns out if you can eat scrambled eggs, you know, you can get all the vaccines as well. So I think that most people, so we've really, I think, gone away from being too concerned about the egg thing. Certainly if people have true anaphylaxis from eggs, Those are the people that really do need to be cautious. As far as the multiple shots thing, I think there's two sides of that. One is the immune reactions, and the other is just sort of how it makes a kid feel. I used to run an international adoption clinic, and I think, as people know, when kids arrive or start their vaccinations later in life, they can sometimes be up for, you know, as many as 7 injections.
And we
ran a study for a while that we basically gave people the option of sort of deciding what was the maximum number of injections they would want to give their kid and let them try that. And we discovered two things. One is most parents got tired of coming back every month to give just a few vaccines at a time. And the other that they taught us was that the kids don't scream any louder after 2 than they do after 5. Most of them really decided that it was actually less traumatic to do a whole bunch of them and get it all over with at once rather than to spread it out and give them once a month. So we really do feel that that actually makes the most sense. The other is that you should be aware that as new vaccines come on, each of them have to be tested with all the other vaccines that would be given at that same visit. And so they actually have to look at all the immunity and actually all the side effects to make sure that there isn't a compounding of the side effects by giving them. So when a new vaccine gets added, the most recent ones for little babies have been the Prevnar vaccine for pneumococcus and the rotavirus vaccine. Mm-hmm. Both of those vaccines had to be tested at the same time in kids with all the other vaccines they would get at that visit to make sure they don't have any kind of reaction.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's really interesting. And it'd be nice to know the pediatrician if they could relay that information, because, I mean, I live an hour and a half away from my pediatrician, so it is a big hassle driving back just for a shot. And you're right, they're not going to cry any more than they would if they get 2 versus 4. I guess my just biggest concern was, is it going to make them feel really, you know, icky inside or painful?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be any more.
To know that they're tested together, that's very interesting.
Yeah, thanks. It sure is. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. That is very interesting. That's something I hadn't known about or had forgotten about from the last time you were with us, maybe. Marcia and Marcusan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The good man just answered my question pretty much. I know of a family who seems to have children with immune problems. And again, my question is, to pump so many vaccines into a child, I still feel very strongly that that can cause problems, because one of the children at about two years old developed autism, or at the top of the spectrum, and he's fine now. But it was felt that it was caused from the vaccines being pumped into his system. And they have another child who has an immune problem also. She's currently being treated at Children's Hospital. But you don't know when you have a child who has an immune system and a problem. And so does a family have to commit to giving so many vaccines at one time? I do feel that that is a load on a young child's system.
Well, you raise a couple interesting points, and let me see if I can break this out into a couple of things. One is, for kids that genuinely have immune deficiencies, I think we do recognize two things. One is, for certain types of immune deficiencies, they may just not respond very well and may not get much protection from the vaccine. And so there are certain vaccines we just don't bother giving to certain kids with certain immune deficiencies. The other is that those immune deficient kids, if they actually get the actual disease, really can get very, very, very tragic versions of those diseases. So, for instance, influenza in a kid who's on chemotherapy or something like that is really quite devastating.
Oh.
And so I think it's very important, even if they're not going to get a fabulous immune response, to at least give them some protection. It's even more important to make sure that the people that are in their surroundings, the rest of the family, are fully immunized so that they don't bring those diseases back to those kids and actually introduce them. Secondly, when you raise the question about autism, most kids with autism are diagnosed somewhere between 1 and 2 years of age, because one of the diagnostic criteria is loss of or failure to have language process. And so when you're thinking about when kids actually have language and start talking, it's at that same time after they've had most of their usual childhood vaccines. But despite multiple studies that have absolutely proven that there's absolutely no link whatsoever, this continues to sort of percolate, that people continue to sort of put these two things together. And really what it is, unfortunately, it's an association but not causation. So just because something happens after something else doesn't by any means mean that the two things are actually linked. And so there's been countless studies that have been published that have clearly shown that there's really no link between immunizations and autism. It's unfortunate that they're coincidental, that the two things happen around the same time.
Yeah, that is very, very sad. So there's association and not causation.
Correct.
Yeah. Marcia, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Rocky and Nishkoro a chance to join us. Rocky, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I was concerned with all these immigrants coming across the border in flocks and groves. Are they immunized? And they're getting spread across the country? What's the chances of them spreading any communicable diseases?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, you know, the WHO runs an expanded program on immunization in most countries that helps those countries try to offer vaccines to most of the children in those countries. But they, as many countries do, have access issues where not all the kids do get immunized. And so one of the things that we do always worry about is importation of disease from any number of ways, including more often than not people getting off a plane and returning from someplace where they've picked up a disease. And that's really one of the reasons that we continue to emphasize why people need to immunize their kids here, is because even though these diseases may not circulate routinely here, they're out there.
Yeah.
And so we've had outbreaks recently, including families that were brought back children from China that were being adopted, who actually brought measles into the country and then spread into their own community. So I think you raise a good point, and it's exactly the reason why we can never let our guard down and never fail to continue to want to protect our kids just in case.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And I think about the University of Wisconsin here. We're a worldwide, you know, sort of international organization here. And every semester, at the end of the semester, we send everybody home to the four corners of the earth, all to come back a few weeks later with whatever cold or flu or you have, you name it, they can get from home. And in this day and age where you can be around the world in a matter of a day, it's pretty easy to see why these things can spread so quickly and why we need to have the vaccines. Jane in Eau Claire up next. Jane, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was going to say the benefits of having your chicken pox is you don't get shingles when you get older.
Yeah, is that
no, true? Actually, one of the things that you need to realize is that when you get shingles as an older individual, that is your original chicken pox from when you were a child that has lain.
Oh, I know. I've had it three times now.
Yeah, and so you know, the shingles that people get as they get older or as they get immune deficiencies later in life is reactivation of your original chicken pox from when you were young. And so that's the whole goal in trying to do two things with two different types of vaccines. So there's a zoster vaccine, which prevents that shingles, called Zostavax, which is given to older individuals to boost their immune system so it remembers to keep that chickenpox that's still in your body quiet and keep it suppressed. And then obviously we've been trying to give children the chickenpox vaccine, which is just a very mild version of the chickenpox virus, with the idea that they then are protected and don't get real wild type chickenpox, or if they get chickenpox, they get a very, very mild case, and then are that therefore less likely later in life to actually end up with shingles.
Oh, yeah. You don't want shingles, I don't think.
No, it sounds like
I would not wish shingles on anyone.
Oh.
That is so painful. You have a small case of Tourette's syndrome for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
it feels like you're being cattle prodded, you know? You see a cow jump or something, and it's just all your nerve endings are not firing on all three.
Wow. Well, it is a good reminder for people that vaccines are not just for children. In fact, we have vaccines now that we actually have across the entire spectrum of life. And that at the later end of life, there are really a lot of diseases that are really very challenging and worth protecting people against, including, besides shingles, influenza, as well as pneumococcus, which is the most common cause of pneumonia in the elderly.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate the call. My understanding is that getting your child vaccinated not only provides protection for them, but for others around them who may not be able to get vaccinated. Is that true, really?
That is very true. I mean, this whole concept of herd immunity is that we protect our individual children themselves by giving them vaccines. But then the idea is that as people kind of pull together in the same direction and everybody immunizes their children, those kids that can't get the vaccines or those rare people that just don't have a full immune response to the vaccine then benefit from the fact that everybody else is vaccinated and don't bring the diseases back and don't share them around with other people in their surroundings. So, you know, we really look at sort of two good reasons to immunize. Right. One is to protect your kid individually, but the other is to protect everybody else. And we always have to remember that kids are really the ultimate as far as disease-spreading machines. You know, we teach them to work and play well with others and share, and they go to school and pick up all sorts of different organisms from other kids. And as long as they don't actually contract a version of that that allows them to shed and spread that even further, then we're in good shape. But when you look at big influenza outbreaks, the single biggest predictor of an adult getting exposed and infected by flu is having a kid. And so you really, I think, in many ways are protecting yourself by making sure your children are protected.
One year, many years back, I did not get my flu shot, and I got the flu. And believe me, that will never happen again. I will never fail to get my flu shot.
It is a stiff reminder when you get one of those things and when one slips through. My wife missed hers one time as well has regretted it.
We have vaccinations for the schedules for babies. There are quite a few that they get as children.
Well, we now have separate schedules. We have a childhood schedule that takes you up until age 7. Then there's actually an adolescent platform. And so teenagers then get a group of vaccines as they go into middle school. And as I mentioned, then we've got essentially vaccines across the entire spectrum of life. With different ages, but also with different types of medical conditions. So we have certain medical conditions. Pregnancy is probably one of the most important ones. Pregnant women really need to be protected. They have immune problems just by being pregnant, and they also have a little one who's going to be coming along. And so pregnant women are some of the groups that we really want to focus on, getting them their flu vaccine and also making sure that they get the Tdap vaccine so that they're actually giving their baby then some whooping cough immunity so the baby is protected from the very get-go.
Oh, that's great. What's the most important thing you want parents to know here as we kind of winding up here about the importance of getting kids vaccinated? Let's go back to that.
I think that the two things is that they should be reassured that there really is an incredibly robust safety system that really does monitor these things. And I think that they should also recognize that the vaccines are designed to be given at a time when the immune system can handle the process and when the kids are at particularly high risk for those diseases or for having complications from those diseases. So this idea of either spreading them out or delaying them really in many ways sort of defeats the purpose. That the idea is really to protect the kid at the time when they're actually most vulnerable and to get them immunity that then will stretch out and last through their entire vulnerable stage. You know, it's one of those things when people start to try to pick and choose vaccines, it's almost like the analogy of saying that you can know ahead of time which day you're going to get into a fender bender and then just put your kid's car seat or your seatbelt on that day. It just doesn't work that way. You don't know what day you're going to come into contact with these things, but we know that they keep reemerging and they keep being reintroduced.
Thank you so much for being with us. I hope we can do this again.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate it. Dr. James Conway is professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. It was some great information. Get your children or make sure your grandchildren are vaccinated. Make sure of that. Tomorrow at 11, it's time for, we got lots of good things in store. I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.